You're listening to On the Ward podcast. Stay tuned.
Hello guys, welcome to another episode of the On the Ward podcast, and I'm your host, Reginald.
So on this episode, we're going to be discussing acute intestinal obstruction. And to help me do that, I have a special guest on the show, Sherif. Sherif is a fourth-year medical student at the University of Ghana School of Medicine and Dentistry and has a bachelor's degree in biochemistry. He's also a co-author on the research paper titled Characterization of Two New Multi-Drug Resistant Strains of Mycobacterium spignatus. He also has research experience working with WABIP in the Laboratory for Chemical Systems, Biology of Infectious Pathogens. Welcome to the show, Sherif.
Thank you, Reginald. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
That's quite an impressive resume you have there. So before we get right into it, how's your break been ever since the coronavirus pandemic hit Ghana in March?
It's definitely changed how like normal is now. Because, well, for starters, it's given us a well-deserved break from medical education, which can be stressful, as we all know. We've got like three months off of school.
Three months.
Yeah, so that has given us the chance to, first of all, relax, which I can't overstate how refreshing that was. And it's also given us the chance to try other things outside of medicine. So, I mean, I've been taking some online classes. I picked up a new hobby. I started drawing. I started singing, but you're not ready to hear that. Then I took a few online courses. Yeah, I started learning a new language online.
Duolingo. It's a lot of stuff.
You know Duolingo?
Yeah, I know Duolingo.
It's a very impressive app. It's got me speaking Italian in 2 days.
Wow. I think you should all try that. Some of us should download the app and try and see whether we can learn some new
languages. Of course, not sponsored.
All right.
But yeah. As is, thanks to Duolingo, I know Senor Boschettino Boschettales.
Hey, wow.
I haven't asked the meaning yet. That's tomorrow's class.
All right.
But yeah, I mean, it's also helped me try and adventurous stuff. I mean, yeah, it's been a fun experience.
So just making the best of the situation you're in right now.
I hope you've also been using the vacation very well.
Yeah, I have. I've been reading and I've been sleeping as well. You know?
It's necessary. It's very necessary.
Yeah. So let's get right into it. So, Sherif, can you tell us a little bit about acute intestinal obstruction?
Okay, so I'm sure most of our audiences have a background in medicine or other health-related sciences. But for the sake of the few that may not have that background, I'd like to start from the basic anatomy of the digestive system. So basically, as a human being, you have a digestive tract, right? It starts from your mouth and ends in your anus. And between the mouth and the anus is basically just a long cylindrical tube. So the digestive tract, simplified, is a cylindrical tube with two ends. At one end is the mouth, at the other end is the anus. Now, this tract can be divided into three sections. Starting from the mouth, there's the esophagus, the stomach, and then the intestine. Then you end with the anus. Okay. So once you take food through the mouth, it goes through the esophagus, into the stomach, and then into the intestine, then out of the anus. So that's the journey of food through the digestive tract. And it's very important for the normal functioning of a human being that this journey proceeds uninterrupted. Okay. Now, if at any point during the food's journey on this motorway we are calling the digestive tract, the food is stopped from proceeding to the next section, then we say there's been an obstruction. Now, building off of this, we could say an intestinal obstruction is when the movement of food through the intestine is blocked or impeded in whatever way. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's like a stoppage in the passage of intestinal contents through the intestine.
Yeah, I couldn't have put it any better myself.
Okay. So is that okay? So what other description can we give to acute intestinal obstruction? How do we describe? Can you take us through?
Okay. So once food gets into the intestine, the food doesn't have legs, so it can't walk through the intestine. I mean, obviously, right? Unless maybe eat a full chicken or something. Eat chicken legs or chicken wings, and the food can fly. But the food doesn't have legs. It has no intrinsic way of moving through the intestine. So how food moves through the intestine is, the intestine is a muscular tube. And the way it moves food is, it undergoes alternate periods of contraction and relaxation, which we call peristalsis. So this peristalsis propels food through the intestine. So it's basically like when you're taking the last biscuit from the rubber. So you normally squeeze the under to push the biscuit up towards the tip. So that's how food moves through the intestine. So to stop food from moving, you have two options, right? It's either you place a physical obstruction in front of the food. So no matter what force you exert behind the food, it can't move.
Overcome that obstruction.
Okay, all right. Or you inhibit the intestine from being able to contract and relax, so to undergo peristalsis. So in that case, it's not able to propel the food forward. Okay. So based on this, intestinal obstruction is basically classified under two types. There's the paralytic obstruction and there's the mechanical obstruction. So the paralytic obstruction will be when you've essentially paralyzed the intestine. So it can't undergo peristalsis for propulsion of food to occur. And on the other hand, you have the mechanical, where there's an actual physical obstruction blocking the food from moving through the intestine.
Okay, that's great. So under acute intestinal obstruction, acute intestinal obstruction can be described with regards to its site and nature. Just as Sherif has explained earlier about it, there being a physical obstruction and also a paralysis to the intestinal musculature. So we're going to describe acute intestinal obstruction based on its site and nature. So can we begin with that too?
Okay, so before that, right, so both of these types constitute intestinal obstruction, right? And this condition can be either acute or chronic, and that just depends on the duration, okay? Yeah. But I think for this episode, we are sticking with acute intestinal obstruction, okay? With acute intestinal obstruction, the obstruction can be classified based on the nature of the obstruction or the site of the obstruction. So that's basically the location of the obstruction.
Okay.
Let's start with the site of the obstruction.
Okay.
So with the site of the obstruction, it's basically can be either high or low. And the distinction between the two of them is based on their proximity to the ampulla of Vater. So basically what you do is, basically the section of the digestive tract from the stomach to the anus, you divide it into two parts, which would be in the middle of the ileum. On the upper half, you would have the duodenum, the jejunum, and the first half of the ileum. So any obstruction that will constitute a high obstruction.
Okay.
Then on the other hand, you'd have the last half of the ileum, and then the colon and the rectum.
Okay.
So that will constitute a low obstruction.
Okay.
Doesn't make sense. This is important because the clinical features of the disease will vary based on
whether the level of the obstruction. Low, yeah.
Okay. Essentially. We'll get into that. I think we'll get into later, that later. So yeah. I'll just jump to the nature of the obstruction. Okay. So acute intestinal obstruction can also be classified based on the nature of the obstruction. Right. So the nature of the obstruction, it can be the simple, a simple obstruction, a closed loop obstruction, a strangulated obstruction, and these have different connotations, right? So if you have the image of the intestine being a cylindrical tube at the back of your mind, you can imagine a single blockage at one point in the tube or one specific part of the tube. In this case, we'll call that a simple obstruction. It's exactly what the name says it is. It's just an obstruction at one point in the tube. In this case, the food cannot move forward. But in certain cases, it can move back.
Okay.
Then there's a step up above that, you have the closed loop obstruction, where now the obstruction is not at one point, but at two points.
Okay.
So you have now, you imagine the cylindrical tube again, you have an obstruction maybe 4 centimeters from the opening of the tube, and then another obstruction 8 centimeters away. So that creates a segment of the intestine between two obstructions. So food is trapped in that segment between the two obstructions. It can't move forward, it can't move backwards.
Okay.
And in the third case, we have a strangulated obstruction. Now, the special thing about a strangulated obstruction is, it's not, I mean, they expect me to say it's three obstructions, right? But that's not what happens. So it can happen in either a simple or a closed loop obstruction. What happens is that, regardless of how many obstructions there are, if the obstruction impairs blood supply to the segment of the bowel that is obstructed, or any segment of the bowel, then you have a strangulated obstruction. So it's basically from the word, I mean, to strangle. If I say I'm strangling, I'm depriving you of oxygen, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So it's basically the same thing. The obstruction is strangling the bowel.
Okay.
So the bowel is deprived of oxygen, and this can get dangerous really quickly.
So the blood supply is cut off.
Exactly.
Sort of. Okay. All right. So that was a great introduction to what acute intestinal obstruction is. So in the world, what are some of the clinical features that we are supposed to look out for in in identifying a case of acute intestinal obstruction.
Okay. So when a patient comes to the hospital with a suspected intestinal obstruction, right, you basically be looking for symptoms and signs, right?
So for those who don't understand what's the difference between a symptom and a sign is, what's a symptom and what's a sign?
Okay, so in medical practice, right, we differentiate symptoms from signs based on basically who is doing the reporting. A symptom is a manifestation of a disease that the patient feels or the patient experiences and then reports to you. Whereas a sign is one you have to elicit to find.
As a physician, you are the one who elicits signs. But symptoms are shown by a patient, or it's a manifestation of a disease by a patient.
Exactly.
Okay.
And a very relatable experience is pain and tenderness. So pain is a symptom because the patient can come and tell you, I have pain here, Dr. Miti. So that's pain. Whereas tenderness is if the part of the body is touched and then the patient
feels reacts to the touch.
Yeah, to the touch.
Like, it's painful. The touch is painful. You can say that's tenderness. Okay.
So we are looking at the features basically in two forms, the symptoms and the signs. So with the symptoms, what you're expecting the patient to report are... very first symptom the patient will report is abdominal pain. And this is very simple to imagine because if there's an obstruction and food material keeps accumulating behind the obstruction, eventually the intestine starts to stretch. And as it stretches, there's some stress on the pain receptors and that causes pain.
But what type of pain are we talking about?
So the pain will be colicky. So colicky pain is basically pain that waxes and wanes. The pain comes and then it goes. It comes and it goes. And this is because of the peristaltic motion of the intestine. So when the intestine contracts, so if you remember, I said peristalsis is alternate contraction and relaxation of the intestine to basically propel food forward. So as it contracts, then it tightens the intestine against the obstruction. And that causes pain. As it relaxes, then there's some relief from the pain. Then it contracts, then you have pain. So the pain comes and goes, it comes and goes.
So it's waxes and wanes. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, so
the second symptom you expect the patient to report is vomiting. And when the vomiting, again, is easy to imagine. If there's an obstruction and you keep eating, the food cannot go forward, so eventually what we'll have to do is it will go back and that will manifest as vomiting.
Okay. So is vomiting always present in acute intestinal obstruction? Like when a patient comes, would they always complain of vomiting?
No, not necessarily. So what happens is that the GIT, you remember I said it's a tube, right? You have the esophagus, then that's the first part. After you have the stomach, then the intestines. And these different parts of the GIT are separated by what we call sphincters. They are basically like doors that make sure that once food goes past the door, it doesn't come out.
Yeah.
And then they operate at specific pressures. What happens is if you have an obstruction in the intestine and you keep ingesting food, eventually food accumulates behind the obstruction. Okay. As the food continues to accumulate, the pressure builds up. If the pressure builds up enough to overcome the pyloric sphincter, which is the sphincter between the stomach and the intestine, then the food can now move backwards from the intestine into the stomach. And then from there, it would travel up the esophagus and then it will manifest as vomitus.
Okay.
So whether vomiting will occur or not depends on the level of the obstruction. So the higher it is, thus the closer it is to the pyloric sphincter, the faster it will build up sufficient pressure to overcome the pyloric sphincter. On the other hand, if it's low, it takes a long time for sufficient pressure to build up to overcome the pyloric sphincter.
For vomiting to occur.
For vomiting to occur.
Okay. So what are some of the descriptive features of the vomitus? Usually when a patient comes, how would they describe the vomitus for us to know that this patient is talking about acute intestinal obstruction?
Okay. So for the vomitus in acute intestinal obstruction, you'd expect, if there's vomitus, you'd expect it to have a greenish tinge. And this is because in the duodenum, which is a part of the intestine, right, there's the pleurovator, which contains the bile duct. So over there, bile is secreted through the bile duct into the lumen of the intestine. And bile, when it's secreted, has a greenish color, okay? So if it's secreted into the intestine and it mixes with the food substance in the intestine, the food gets a greenish tinge to it. And if that food is then vomited out, then you expect the vomit to be green. This is important to differentiate it from gastric outlet obstruction, which is another topic we'll hopefully discuss on this case on a later date. But with GOO, the obstruction is above the ampulla vita, so that no bile is secreted, and then the vomitus basically has no green tinge. The color depends on the color of the food you eat, but then there's no green tinge to it. So that would be the characteristics of the vomit in an acute intestinal obstruction.
And also, I must add that sometimes the vomitus can be feculent, depending on how long the obstruction has stayed for. So the vomitus can be foul-smelling and have a feculent nature. All right. Okay. So can we move on to the next feature?
So the next symptom you'd expect the patient to report is constipation. And it's very simple to imagine, because if there's an obstruction or if there's a blockage to the movement of food through the intestines, then obviously you cannot get to the anus to be expelled as feces. So then it would manifest as constipation.
So is the constipation absolute?
So whether it's absolute or not, it depends on the degree of obstruction. So you can have a complete or a partial obstruction. If the obstruction is complete, then it's filled up the entire lumen. Nothing can go through. So the person would have absolute constipation, that the person will not pass feces or flatus. But then the obstruction can be partial. Solid matter cannot bypass the obstruction, but then gaseous substances could. So the patient will manifest as constipation, but then he'll be able to pass flatus. So I think the issue is important to distinguish between constipation and constipation, because it will tell you a lot about the degree and the nature of the obstruction that's present.
And how long the obstruction has been for. Because usually the intestinal contents distal to the obstruction can be passed out, and the patient might pass to until later on those intestinal contents are passed, then you can have the absolute constipation.
Okay, so that's with high and low obstructions.
Yeah.
So when in a high obstruction, right, what happens is that if the obstruction is high, the contents of the intestine proximal to the obstruction will not be able to move, but there's still a very significant length of intestine after the obstruction, and those would still contain digested food. Okay. Those can still pass on through the intestine to the anus. It's only after those contents have been cleared that constipation will manifest in a high constipation. Whereas if you have a low obstruction, the section of the intestine close to the anus is very short, so the digested matter after the obstruction is very small. So maybe like after one or two bowel movements, constipation will manifest. Whereas in a high obstruction, where the segment is longer, the person will be able to go through like 5 or 6 or more
bowel movements
before constipation will manifest.
Okay. All right.
The next symptom you expect to manifest is abdominal distension. And this is as a result of the accumulation of food behind the obstruction. So as the food keeps on coming and keeps on accumulating, first the intestine enlarges. As it enlarges, it gets to a point, it starts to expand the entire abdomen with it. So that will cause some distension if the obstruction is not relieved. Food is continually ingested.
So is there distension in all cases of acute intestinal obstruction? We see distension in almost every case of acute intestinal obstruction.
So there will be some degree of distension in every case, but then it's more apparent in low obstructions. And this is because in low obstructions, there's more space for food to accumulate. So take your cylinder, you divide it into two parts. Imagine the obstruction is closer to the end of the cylinder and you keep adding contents through the inlet. There's more space for food matter to accumulate and enlarging the intestine before vomiting will occur. Unlike if you have a high obstruction, then the space available for accumulation to occur is lower. So the distension there is not as apparent as if it was in a low obstruction.
Okay.
So that's with the symptoms. But when you start your clinical exams, there are certain signs you'd also expect to pick up. So you'd first of all start with your general examination. And in your general examination, you first expect to see signs of dehydration and shock.
So what are some of the signs of dehydration and shock?
So during your general examination, you would see sunken eyes. You'd see a ferret tank, which is because of the dryness. So the body is lacking water. So most of the mucosal membranes will be dry. So this will manifest as ferret tank. The skin will also lose its elasticity. So you see reduced skin tegor. Then
there are other signs of dehydration you'd expect to pick up, but these are like the most common ones you'd find. Then you can move on to your cardiovascular examination, where because of the dehydration and shock, expect signs of low cardiac output, right? Manifestations of low cardiac output. So first, there'll be tachycardia, the pulse rate will go up, and there'll be hypotension, which is reduced blood pressure, which will manifest as a reduced pulse volume. When you move to abdominal exam, you would first see visible peristalsis, and this is because the intestine is trying its best to contract hard enough to overcome the obstruction.
Relieve the obstruction, sort of.
Mm. Exactly, to dislodge the obstruction. So you see this as visible movements on the surface of the person's abdomen. It's like worm-like motion, or like a wave-like motion. When you palpate, you feel the distension. In very large distensions, you'll be able to see them with your eye. But if not, when you palpate, you'll be able to pick up signs of distension. So the abdomen will be taut, will be tight. And then in severe cases, there might be tenderness. Okay. And then when you percuss, you would expect the percussion notes to be tympanic or hyper-resonant. And this is because of the distension of the abdomen. So it becomes sort of like a drum. So you hit it and hear. Then when you auscultate, you would, in the initial stages, so because the intestine will try to increase the intensity of its contractions to dislodge the obstruction, you would hear high-pitched bowel sounds, which with increased frequency. So that would be the signs you would pick up in an abdominal exam. Depending on the cause, you might find some signs in digital rectal examinations, but I mean, these are enough for now.
All right. So Sherif, thank you very much for this in-depth discussion on acute intestinal obstruction.
Thank you.
Yeah, really, really grateful.
Thank you for the opportunity to, I mean, share the very little I know with a larger audience. I hope it's of value to whoever is listening to it. If even one person is able to get a small amount of value from it, I think that would be okay.
Yeah, that's our aim also, to try and help people get knowledge from this podcast. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks for tuning into On The Ward Podcast.